Welcome to Life and Sirens, Behind and On the Scene, a podcast by first responders. We're your hosts, Sophie,
Jamie,
and Aubrey.
The content provided in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any medical institutions, emergency medical services, or healthcare organizations. Patient privacy is a top priority, and all discussions involving real-world emergency situations are de-identified and altered to ensure confidentiality. Always consult with a qualified healthcare professional or your local EMS protocols before making any decisions regarding patient care or medical practices. Listener discretion is advised, as some topics may include discussions of real-world emergency situations.
Episode of Life and Sirens. So today we're tackling interfacility transfers, or IFTs as they're called, a part of EMS that doesn't get enough credit but is a critical part of the job. And not all services, 911 services I mean, will necessarily run interfacility or long distance transfers. It's something that we are not necessarily doing too much anymore at our full-time jobs, but it is a part of a lot of people's 911 careers, and beyond that, it's a big part of critical care medicine, critical care transports, and fixed wing and rotor wing transports.
So let's look at the big picture of why transfers matter. Interfacility transfers are about getting patients to where they need to be or getting them to definitive care. So some of the different types of transfers that you'll see, like strokes, STEMIs, trauma, or NICU, you're trying to get these patients to a higher level of care. Some patients are going to require some specialty services that their initial presenting hospital does not provide, so like burn units, some transplant centers, or even ECMO. Sometimes there is just a bed availability issue. One hospital may be too full. Some people might need other resources like psych, or they might need rehab after their hospital stay, or repatriation, so getting somebody back to their home after their hospital stay if they had a procedure or just a hospital admission. Over 1.5 million interfacility transfers occur annually in the U.S., according to
NIMSIS
in a 2022 article.
Which is pretty impressive. That's a huge, huge group of calls that we go on. So let's set ourselves up for success even before we hop on the rig or the aircraft to retrieve these patients. When we're at a facility, what are some of the most important questions we might ask? Like, how is this interaction gonna go?
Well, first things first, you always want to talk to the nurse or the provider that is directly in charge of that patient's care. You wouldn't think that that would be a really hard thing to do, but it is really hard to locate yes. that human. But try really hard to get that person, because over dispatch and the radio and everything, it gets really convoluted and watered down, and you never truly know what you're going to. When you do find that human, or have your transfer center or your dispatch ask them, well, first of all, why is this person being transferred? What's the issue? What has already been done here in this facility? And then, what trends should I be aware of? Have they had vital fluctuations? Is their pain difficult to manage? Have we had any big recent changes? And then this one's a big one. You want to get copies of all the paperwork, not just the face sheet, not just that PCS form that, you absolutely need to get funded for this transfer. You want labs. You want imaging. You want a discharge summary or a transfer summary. Make sure that you get discs, any copies of imaging that you need. And those are also going to help a lot, especially in the critical care world. Those labs are going to help kind of gauge your patient care as well. So get familiar with those and make sure you can get all those resources from the provider, both your dispatch, however that happens for you, and yourself when you get there.
So let's think through some of the logistics of these calls. You have to think, this one's kind of obvious, but you have to think of what's the best route to get from A to B. Go ahead and pre-plan or what kind of hospitals you have along that route in case you need to divert if anything wild happens.
This has happened to me before, and I've been it was actually Mary. I was Mary, just tell me every time we're approaching an exit where there's a hospital, like that's how critical our patient was.
I just had one recently where I was acting captain that day, but I told the crew, I said, these are the hospitals that you have between here and where you're going. Yep. I mean, they're going to our local pediatric facility, not our local, like our regional pediatric facility. I said, you have these hospitals between you and that hospital. So if this patient becomes critical or we have like a huge change in condition, this is where you can go.
We have options. We have places. They may not be the best ped suited, but we have access to a provider that is significantly above our licensure. So they can do a lot more sometimes than we can. And I am all for it. Don't be ashamed if you have to take a detour. It happens. I think it's happened to most of us in this room, whether you need blood, something that's not on your rig. There's just things happen.
Or like worst case, not everybody has the same protocols, but like you end up with CPR in progress.
Right.
A lot of times you divert to the closest facility in that event. So just make sure you know where you're going. Especially if you have a relatively young or new provider that is not as familiar with the area as you may be. They might not have worked combo and driven to every hospital in the region.
Exactly.
So they might not have a clue where they're going. So make sure that you plan that.
And maybe just if you do have access to or you need to know like door codes, things like that, end codes for calling in radio report, just make sure you know where you're calling and how to access that facility. And then we also, how far from home will we be? How far are we going? I know I've done some really significant transfers, including Nashville to Atlanta and Nashville to Houston. It's crazy. Like, and I'm not talking fixed wing. I'm talking ground. An ambulance. I know James has done some long ones like that too.
I did Nashville to Detroit.
Yeah.
And it's logistics that we do not think of normally on an ambulance. It is like, how do I take care of this person's like skin degradation?
You know what,
like
the
I have
weirdest?
To roll them, I have to make sure they're comfortable. How do we handle bathrooms?
What the bathroom, that's the one I was gonna say.
Yeah, what do we do for these things? Do we stop and get out? Well, they're bed bound, so we have to change briefs and do chucks, and it is just things that we do not normally do in a transport. It was wild trying to figure out the logistics of this.
For our Nashville to Houston, we had 4 crew members, and then from our Nashville to Atlanta we just had, which if you guys are not familiar with our region, that's about 4 hours, 4.5 hours, so it's not terrible. We only had 2 crew members, so just make sure if it is necessary and it's safest to add another set of hands, because there was no way any of us were gonna make it from Nashville to Houston. And it was straight through, like we stopped to get gas, we stopped for food and for the bathroom. And they were all, like, pre-planned. It was very interesting.
Yeah, that's wild.
That is wild.
I know. I'm like, insurance companies, y'all suck. Because at this point, you do need to put that patient on a fixed wing. That's not fair or ethical, in my opinion.
Yeah, to be on a stretcher in the back of a truck for that long is brutal.
Yeah, that's not comfortable.
That is brutal.
Which, this patient had been in a facility in Nashville for a very long time. And we're going back to their home state. And their family members were like caravanning down there with us, which was helpful, and they brought a mattress pad, twin size mattress pad, goes a long way on a stretcher.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
I know, it was so nice. It was so nice. Anyway, moving on. So since we're gonna be so far from home, do we have everything we need? So we need to make sure if we need extra O2 that we have that. We have a charged monitor, backup batteries, backup pumps, any other specialty supplies. A lot of the time when you're doing these long distance transfers, your patient is a very specialized patient, so there might be some unique needs of that patient. So making sure you know how to troubleshoot all of your supplies, all that good stuff.
I would imagine like ostomy supplies,
yes,
Foleys, like just things that we do not traditionally change or
any
really
of the
manage.
Yeah, like home health type supply list. And for us, when we were doing that really long transfer, the social worker and the nurse of the patient and then the discharge nurse were all with us, and we, like, it was very planned out. We planned literally everything out when we were doing these, dressing changes, when we were going to the bathroom, when we were eating. This patient was luckily on a tube feed, so that was helpful. Like, we didn't have to worry about that. So, like, but all those supplies, some of those you may not be familiar with if you're in emergency medicine, so make sure that either a caretaker or someone at the sending facility is able to like brief you on those things.
Also, to just for clarity's sake, none of these transfers that we have run have been with our current 911 service.
Oh, yeah,
these
yeah.
were all with combo services.
This was convalescent medicine, yes. All right, now my favorite term here, the interfacility rescue mission. So handling the oh crap transfers, which if you've worked in rural EMS, there's a good chance you've done a lot of these as just a field paramedic. And wow, underprepared was I. I mean, some of the scariest transfers I've ever made were in small town EMS. And it is wild to think about how much we were doing with literally nothing.
Right. So, and I feel like those patients are patients that if you located out in the wild are places patients that you would take to your critical access center.
Yes.
Because you're like, wow, we need to stabilize them. But now you have that critical access center calling you and being like, get them out of here.
Like, I came to you for help.
You're like, oh, no.
100%. So let's set the scene here. You arrive for an IFT and realize the patient is not being managed appropriately, or critical interventions were missed or not performed. Sometimes there's things that they just don't have access to or aren't knowledgeable on because it's not something they see frequently. And sometimes in these really tiny ERs, depending on like the time of day, I know I've been to some facilities that at nighttime there's no ER doctor. It might just be the inpatient PA or nurse prac, and that's what you have access to. And if they get delivered something that's emergency, they are not very prepared or always, you know, versed in some of the things that we do in emergency and critical care. Your job shifts from transport mode to rescue mode, and this can be a very delicate space to be in, and feelings can get hurt, people can get defensive, so we need to make sure not only are we maintaining our patient and helping them out, but we need to also truthfully just be a little gentle with the sending facility.
Absolutely. This is a position that you find yourself in where you do not want to be accusatory.
Right.
You don't want to be rude. One, because you want to maintain that relationship, because clearly you're going to be working together for
yes.
quite some time. But secondly, you want to be able to gain access to resources that maybe they do have but didn't realize they needed, or interventions that you would request that we can start together that they maybe haven't done. And the best way to do that is not to insult the sending facility first.
Exactly.
It is to ask questions like, do you think, would you mind, can we please? Those are all ways to phrase something like, what would you think about? And it's a way to engage a provider with you.
Yeah, we That's can like, teach each other things.
Yeah, what would you think about if we initiated this prior to leaving? And a lot of times if you come at it in an inquisitive way, the providers are much more open to working with you. Because whether we like to admit it or not, we all have an ego. And
Absolutely.
So if you immediately come in and punch their ego in the face, they will not be willing to help you.
And punching a doctor's ego in the face never helped a patient.
Never did. Because that's the goal, right? The goal is to get your patient out of here as safely as you possibly can with the best care and the most resources.
Right.
And so if and I don't want to say if pandering, but for lack of a better term, if pandering to the provider
yeah.
and their ego is the best way for you to do that and to maintain a good working relationship, then by all means.
It just is what it is. Another thing is just keep in mind, like, if your patient is significantly worse than reported, it might not necessarily be because they just didn't give, you know, dispatch or the call center the appropriate information. A, the patient could have declined significantly. And then B, there's like transfer centers and things like that with filled with people who are not medically trained necessarily, so they're just provided X amount of information and then they call around until they can get somebody to transfer this patient. So don't immediately blame, you know, the facility if you get a call for a patient who's just going for a surgical consult and turns out they have completely like dehisced their zipper scar and they're decompensating and it's just chaos. Yeah, they're going to their surgeon at another facility. But it's because like 800 other things were happening before that. It does happen. It just, that's the reality of the job. Chaos follows. And like sometimes critical interventions aren't done. So maybe you don't have IV access or the airway isn't secured and your patient's in respiratory failure. Or maybe you need pressors. It's okay to just either sometimes you can ask the facility, hey, can we get this on board? Or, hey, had you all planned on getting this on board? Because sometimes they just gotten to that step yet. Like, maybe it's coming from pharmacy. So, like, you can ask for those things. Obviously, be kind and, you know, work together with that facility. But sometimes they just have this patient come through the doors, immediately start working on them, and then say, call for a transfer. So, like, by the time we get there, depending on where we're coming from, it could be, you know, 30 minutes. And they were hoping they'd have an hour to get this patient set up for transfer.
And if you get on the scene of a transfer like this, and those are the things that are happening, you have to kind of weigh your risk versus reward. Mm-hmm. So is this truly a load and go patient where they would benefit from less time to definitive care? Or is this going to be like a stay and play patient where you remain on scene in that facility, work with those providers to establish all of these interventions? Is that going to benefit them more?
Yes, and sometimes that is okay. I've had, which I have even made a note of this, it happens where the facility thinks they did or feels like they did everything that they could in their power, and then we come and we have to do a bunch of things, and that's okay. But sometimes those bunch of things to make sure the patient's stable enough for transport have to get done as quickly as possible, but sometimes it might take an hour. And there was a time where I actually got complained on for taking too long to transport the patient, because you also have to think these sending facilities are usually very anxious with these type of sick patients, so they were not expecting this very sick patient to come to them, and then they panicked, for lack of better terms, and they called you immediately. They didn't do everything that they maybe hope they could do, or we just had to do a lot when we got there. So document. Literally, this happened to me, and my director just read them my report, and they were just like, oh. Because, I mean, obviously, just document what you find and what you had to do. Don't put your feelings in it, but, like, document the crap out of that stuff, because it is reality that we have to sometimes work pretty hard when we get there, and that's okay, but sometimes that upsets people when we don't just load and go, because in their eyes, that's all we are to them. Get it out of here.
That's what I was going to say, is how many times have y'all been on a scene, like a 911 scene, where we are actively working on a patient? We are actively doing something, and family, and there's only two of us.
Right.
So like, yes, someone has to drive, but right now I need your help. And family is like, why haven't you started moving? Why aren't you going somewhere? Or the patient is like, why aren't we going to the hospital right now?
Definitely.
And a lot of times people have the, especially in the pre-hospital side, they're like, this is just a hospital taxi. Mm-hmm. That is worse when you get into interfacility transfers.
Oh, yeah.
Because they truly are just, in their minds, they are just calling you to take them somewhere else. And they forget that you're calling a mobile ER, and in the case of critical care, a mobile ICU, yep, to come manage this patient while getting them somewhere else. And I think that sometimes we have to remind them nicely that you didn't call a taxi. You actually called other healthcare providers.
Right.
And sometimes that is that's a tough bridge to gap.
I think it still comes down to how new EMS and interfacility and critical care transport is, and our careers have, like, this field is very short-lived so far. Like, it hasn't been happening for that long. 50 years of EMS, right? I'm pretty sure the first critical care transport in Nashville was 1972, if what I remember correctly, which is impressive, but it was for specialty care. Okay, it was for pediatric specialty care. So if you think how standardized critical care and interfacility transport is now, like, it's still fresh, and mm-hmm. a lot of these doctors and sending providers just, we are a hope and a prayer. We're not supposed to be doing things. Just get them out of here. Do that stuff with your truck. I don't want to see the chaos. I get it. But sometimes it's just, it's a lot roomier, even in your 6-bed ER, I promise. All right, let's talk about, so sometimes we get there, there's things that need to be done, but we might need to call medical control. And who is our medical control when we're transferring a patient? According to the test, it's the receiving facility. But once you get off property, the receiving is your medical control.
Okay, nice. That makes far more sense, because clearly one hospital is transferring to the other because they don't have the resources.
And they've accepted the patient.
Yeah, and so it makes more sense for them to be your medical control.
Theoretically, you can always call for medical control for orders by your receiving facility. So if things are just a little chaotic, for example, the sending facility has introduced a procedure or intervention to your patient that isn't appropriate and you have to undo it. Like you have to take something out, or like that might be a good time to call your receiving facility, stuff like that. Also, you can just operate within your guidelines and your protocols, but when in doubt, call for help. So it might sound like this when you're calling medical control, and I think this is really important to add in there because I did not know how to call medical control. I did not know. I was like, I need help. What do you want me to do? Probably don't do that. It does not exude confidence. So it might look like this. You call via phone or radio, whatever your procedure is for the receiving facility. We're en route to you with a patient. Give them the information. They are decompensating. They are reported stable, but we are now managing X, Y, or Z. Do you want us to adjust this treatment, continue transport, or divert? Maybe you want to suggest in there a specific treatment that you have within your protocols. Or sometimes you can just give them what you got, what you've already done, what the receiving or the sending facility rather has done, and ask for recommendations. Sometimes there's truly just really weird transfers and really weird, you know, patient conditions, and that's probably why they're going to a specialty center that really we don't typically intervene on, and they might have some trick up their sleeve, especially when they're these big regional facilities who are always receiving patients and are always getting these phone calls of what do I do next. So don't be afraid to ask for help.
We also have to remember, especially in the critical care world, that ICUs operate differently than EDs and a lot of the other floors that we are more familiar with. There is a lot of permissive conditions with these patients. And so it may be vital signs or things that we see that this is like an oh shit moment for us, where we're like, that is absolutely unacceptable. But that's because we are very number driven. And a lot of times in these ICUs, they will permissively allow someone to be mildly acidotic or mildly hypoxic or mildly hypotensive or the opposite of those things, because that's kind of the best place that they can be balancing all of their conditions. And so you want to make sure that if the sending facility doesn't know, that you ask the receiving facility, where am I at? What are my parameters? Yeah. What would you like me to attempt to change? What would you not like me to attempt to change? Because sometimes they want them where they are, and that might not be something we're very comfy with.
Yeah, I was going to say, sponge is just a little uncomfy. Mm-hmm. You're like, what? That's the pressure. Are you sure?
Yes, I don't like those numbers, but patient condition and numbers don't always equate. So you've got to make sure you know kind of where your baseline is.
100%. So here's an oh crap scenario. Here's the case. He was stable when we called you. you're dispatched to a transfer of a 56-year-old septic patient from a rural ER to a major ICU. When you arrive, the BP is 72 over 40, but they have no IV fluids running. They are on a norepinephrine drip, but there is no pump. It's being run by gravity. The nurse says, we just gave a fluid bolus an hour ago, so we didn't get another line. And the patient is becoming less responsive. So what's our next move? What do you think?
Another line.
Definitely another line.
Probably put that pressor on a pump, get some fluid going.
Yeah, I'd say it's unlikely that you're going to get any central venous access because this is a tiny rural ER. So definitely another line, if possible. Or maybe you have to drill them. That sucks. If you had to pick, okay, you have an IO and you have just a peripheral IV and you have IV fluids and you have nor epi. Well, it goes where?
Where's your peripheral IV? Where is it located?
Left AC.
You would do your pressor through the IO? No? Through the IV?
We might have to look this up, but I'm pretty sure it's preferred that you do it peripherally than through an interosseous space.
I imagine that through a tibial, you would have a high pressure, and so your pump would be really mad. Right. It would think it was occluded all the time.
100%. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. But I think that through a humeral IO, your pump would not be nearly as irritated because it doesn't necessarily even need a pressure bag normally when we free flow, like gravity flow fluids. So that actually might be okay. And
And you might have
the efficacy of a humeral IO is like pretty ballin'.
That's what I was gonna say. They might already have a tibial IO, but more than likely we're gonna be the ones placing the humeral. Mm-hmm. They just, it's not something that you often see in the hospital because everybody has drugs are down here, airways up there. It's just easier because there's so many people.
Yeah, if you see an IO at all, it's gonna be a tibial.
Yeah. Anyway, so we've gotten additional IV access or interosseous access. What else do we want to do?
So they are septic, and so I would request for this facility to initiate antibiotics prior to our transfer. That does have a caveat, though. It depends on how much pump access you have.
Yeah.
So in the event that you're really working with limited pump capabilities, then your antibiotics are not going to be your highest priority, because clearly we need to keep them stable before that. But if you do have a decent amount of pumps that you can access, then I think antibiotics would be a great decision.
All right. They're becoming less responsive too, it says.
Oh, well, let's see what that airway's doing, I guess.
Yeah, I would say we just want to check out that airway, see what less responsive means. Mm-hmm. That could literally mean anything. Mm-hmm. Or it could mean nothing. It just depends who's telling you that. So yeah, make sure airway is patent and they're capable of protecting it. Let's talk about what makes someone a great transport provider. Here are just a few. Just a reminder, you're not just a patient attendant. You're an extension of the hospital team. I know that sounds weird when we're in pre-hospital medicine because we don't always feel part of that team. It almost sometimes feel like we're in competition, but you are an extension of the hospital, especially in transfer scenarios. There's so many things happening and you guys need to be cohesive. You need to be calm under pressure, especially when it comes to interpersonal communications. IFTs about keeping patients stable for the long haul, but also making sure that we are communicating effectively with sending and receiving facilities and making sure we're all on the same page. Got to think ahead, expect unexpected, and prepare for it. Know how to troubleshoot all of your equipment, have extra equipment, that kind of thing.
Especially with meds, make sure that you, a lot of times like a good rule is to make sure that you can continue medicating that patient effectively for an hour longer than you think you need to. Especially if you have a longer transport time, because you never know, like, if you're going to be stuck on the interstate, if there's going to be shutdowns, if you're going to have bad weather, like, you just don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so make sure that you have an extended period of time past what you'll actually need with all your meds.
If they need to send you with a cooler of blood, I've done that before, let them send you with the cooler. I'd much rather have blood to bring back to you than my patient to empty out their blood in my ambulance.
Yes.
Just remember that it's all about how you handle things. Stay cool as a cucumber, and it'll probably be fine.
Yeah, for sure.
And if it's not, then you know what to do.
Right, and work on your communication. Make sure that you are effectively communicating your goals. Make sure that you are clear in your requests for treatment and interventions.
Truly.
And if you do that kindly, for the most part, you won't have any trouble.
Yeah. And also, for me, I was really nervous about giving radio report on these more complex patients if it was necessary for me to give radio report. So there's no harm in writing it down. That's okay. I used to write down every single radio report that we did to our regional trauma center. I still do. Yeah. And that's okay. That is okay. So do whatever method works best for you. Take care of yourself. These long distance interfacility transfers can truly take a lot out of you. It's a lot of big brain thinking. Speaking of big brain thinking, let's talk about our trivia questions.
What are three signs that a interfacility transport has become a rescue mission?
They do not have the appropriate capabilities to even intervene a little bit. It's basically just like an ambulance simulation. Like, you know, in school when they have the ambulance simulator that has the wall cut out of it? Sometimes that's basically all you got.
Yeah.
But it's inside of a hospital, and they're like, well.
Or it's like it's like in paramedic school where you're like, hey, I want this.
No.
And like, that's broken. You say, okay, well, now I want this. And they're like, they don't have it. Okay, well, now I need this. And they're like, that all got lit on fire last week. And yes. There's constantly nothing that you actually need. If that's happening to you in real life.
Probably a rescue mission.
It is a rescue mission.
When should you call medical control during a transfer?
Anytime you feel uncomfy, really, I think. You know, if you feel like you have to intervene and there's not a protocol or, you know, pre-authorized step that you can take, err on the side of caution and call medical control.
What's a professional way to handle a situation where a patient wasn't properly managed at the sending facility?
It is in our EMS nature to want to make sure that people that have done something wrong know that they have done something wrong. That is not necessarily the case when you're interacting with a sending facility. So if their interventions have been appropriate or they haven't done what they need to do, then you kind of move on from making sure that they know that's the case and you start interacting with them in ways that is beneficial for the patient. So requesting different interventions, requesting the DC interventions, even down to like the I'm not comfortable managing that en route. Is it okay if we DC it until we get to this other facility? Maybe a kinder way to say that was probably not good to do.
Let's do something else.
Yeah.
So let's there's pivot.
Pivot. So there's ways around communicating with a sending facility that does not make them angry at you. And contrary to our EMS hearts, everyone does not need to know everything that they have done wrong.
Why is long-distance transport fatigue a real concern for EMS crews?
Anytime we're spending a lot of hours doing high acuity or things that require a lot of our attention, it's exhausting. Even if you're just sitting by the patient and monitoring vitals and drips, it's still exhausting. I think that any of us could say that about a shift where we don't even run that many calls. You will always be tired afterwards because your body is just in high alert mode. So exhaustion is a big factor, dehydration, just making sure you're taking care of yourself, making sure that when you need a break and it's necessary for your personal safety, crew safety, and patient safety, that you're voicing that, I think.
Yeah. And remind yourself that other realms of transport, they have very strict rules on fatigue. So crew members, they have like a fatigue limit, especially pilots, they have hours so that they are guaranteed not to be fatigued. All these things, but with a ground ambulance, they're like, and go. And no one really cares. As long as you haven't worked 96 hours in a row, everyone's pretty much like, yeah, go ballin'.
They might not even care if there's a tornado.
Right? A lot of times they don't. So just remember that you have to be your own advocate when it comes to fatigue and being able to say, like, I am not actually safe in this role right now.
For sure.
Whether that is driving or providing care or whatever it is. But you're the only person that's going to ask you. So make sure that you do that.
What's one thing that you should always confirm before leaving on a transfer?
Make sure whoever's responsible for getting you there, the pilot or maybe your partner, EMT partner, knows the appropriate address. Because some hospitals might start with the same thing. Like we have medical center and then location. And this could happen, like this happens everywhere, especially in our region. There's a lot of ascensions and there's a lot of places you could go backwards. Like, you're going the absolute wrong direction for help. So just be sure you confirm. And there was a time period, I don't know why, I was like hyper concerned that we were going to go to the wrong place. I don't know. I think it was just when I was a new medic. And I'd be like, okay, this is the address, right? This is what you got. Like, I'd be so paranoid. But just make sure you know where you're going.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah.
I also would say that before leaving on a transfer, make sure that you, on the same vein of that you confirm exactly where you're going. Sometimes where you intuitively think a patient should go is not actually where they are going.
For sure.
Right? Yeah. So I'm like, this is clearly a level one. I'm going to take them to our regional level one center, but there's actually a specialty they need that's somewhere else. So I actually didn't even ask where we're going because I thought I knew.
Yeah, just make sure. It's on the paperwork.
Just double check.
Check your paperwork. Confirm with the sending. IFTs can be routine, but they can also be the most high pressure calls you handle. And that even goes for convalescent transport. Those are some of the sickest patients you might encounter. They're chronically ill, terminally ill patients. Be prepared, be adaptable, and be an advocate for yourself and your patients. And with that, please follow us on social media if you have any crazy IFT rescue mission stories you'd like to share with us. You can send those to lifeinsirenspod@gmail.com. And please don't get lost on your next transfer.
This has been Life in Sirens, produced by three nerds trying to bring you content that you might actually care about.